On the agenda for the pre-council meeting is police forfeiture funds.
There are a couple of handouts that you'll find in the packet, and Chief Burton is here to lead us through an overview of police forfeiture funds.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Mr. Mathis, you'll recall a few months ago that there were some questions about forfeiture and how it works as it relates to the police department. So I've asked a couple of members of my staff to prepare some presentations for you, so just a few minutes of your time. First, I'm going to ask our new police legal advisor, Nicole Volkert, to come forward, and then right after her, Lisa Rowland, who is our financial management specialist within the department, will have a presentation for you.
I'm Nicole Volkert, and I'm an assistant city councilor, and I've been asked to talk to you very briefly about the guidelines for participation in the Federal Asset Forfeiture Equitable Sharing Program. All of the forfeiture asset funds that the Columbia Police Department has ever brought before the city council, they have done as a result of their participation in this program. So you've been given a handout which outlines some of the main guidelines of the program. It also has two links that you can see at the top of it, and these links are to the federal government websites. They're actually two links because there are actually two different departments which have virtually similar programs. There is one through the Department of Justice, which involves any federal asset forfeitures that are done through the Department of the Drug Enforcement, the DEA, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Office of Inspector General, the United States Attorney's Office. Those are all through the Department of Justice. And there's a separate one through the Department of Treasury, which does the Internal Revenue Service, the Customs and Border Patrol. For the purposes of this short presentation, I will just refer to them as the federal program, even though there are, in fact, two programs, because they are virtually similar, and they don't really affect how things are handled on the local level. The Federal Asset Forfeiture Program encompasses the seizure and forfeiture of assets that represent the proceeds or were used to facilitate a federal crime. And the primary mission of the Federal Asset Forfeiture Fund program is to employ asset forfeiture in such a manner as to disrupt and dismantle criminal organizations. And this is accomplished by removing the proceeds of crime and other assets that are relied on upon by the criminals and their associates that participate in the criminal activity against our society. And that is the goal of the Federal Asset Forfeiture Program. Equitable sharing is a subset of the federal forfeiture program, and it refers to the expenses and the amounts that are paid to state and local law enforcement agencies for their assistance in cases that result in federal forfeiture assets. The equitable sharing payments reflect the degree of direct participation by the local law enforcement efforts that result in the forfeiture. And as I stated before, all of the forfeiture funds brought before this council by the police department have been as a result of the participation in that federal equitable sharing program. And now I'll briefly describe a little bit about the process. Equitable sharing expenses and amounts are determined entirely by the federal agency, whether it be the Department of Treasury or the Department of Justice. The amounts are not distributed to anyone, whether it be a federal agency or a state or local law enforcement agency, until after a federal judge, justice, or magistrate makes a determination that forfeiture is appropriate. And that judicial determination would include a finding that forfeiture is appropriate and that the assets represent the proceeds or were used to facilitate a federal crime. That process, like any judicial process, may take a while to reach conclusion. Therefore, no one that participates in this program can ever predict the timing of when a federal judge, justice, or magistrate is going to, in fact, rule on the federal forfeiture. Once the judicial ruling takes place, the appropriate federal authority would make the determination of what each contributing agency's equitable share would be. So, for example, where this comes into play is that oftentimes you have multiple agencies assisting in what's an investigation of a larger criminal enterprise. It's up to that federal agency to determine which local law enforcement agency gets what percentage. So if you have an investigation that is large and that encompasses multiple agencies, you might actually have a larger criminal enterprise, multiple agencies involved, and therefore each agency would have a different percentage. And it's up to the federal government to determine what the equitable share is. Thereafter, the equitable sharing funds are transferred to the local law enforcement agencies. In Columbia, our local police department then begins a separate process of then requesting from council in the form of an ordinance, the ability to use their equitable share pursuant to the guidelines set forth. And then this is when you can look at the handout and see some of the things that are set forth in terms of guidelines for what is an acceptable use of the equitable sharing funds. One of the, I think, probably highlights of it, more importantly, is the goal of the federal government in having this program is that they want to increase and not replace any funds for a local law enforcement agency. There's probably two main reasons for that. One is that, as I stated before, you have no way to predict when it's going to take place because it's all determined on a judicial process, and also because you don't know how much your equitable share is going to be. So there's really no predictability in terms of timing or amounts for the federal forfeiture funds. So the guidelines are listed. They are listed on the website. And now Ms. Rowland can tell you a little bit more about what has been done in the past.
The second sheet you should have shows the revenue that we have received in the equitable sharing funds for the past three fiscal years. In 2010, we received $61,165. Of this amount, seven deposits came from the Justice and none from the Treasury. In 2011, we received $41,769. Of that, four came from the Justice Department, five from the Treasury. And then in fiscal year 12, we brought in $121,964, with six being from the Justice Department and 10 from the Treasury. And then right below that, I've showed where we have spent the money over the past 3 years. And as you can see, we've bought undercover narcotics vehicles, camera systems for investigations, electronic investigative tools, replaced our CVSA, we funded the bait card program, some SWAT equipment, computer and electronic items for our conference room at the police department, Axon cameras and training equipment. This was actually a supplement to a burn grant where we had received money for the burn grant and we needed just a little bit more to finish out what we needed to do, so we had that. We did in-car video server equipment repair. When our system went down, we needed $22,000, so we used it for that. And then the last expenditure that we've had is the consultant review of our property and evidence unit. That's all I have.
I have a question for Ms. Volkert, I believe. We've had advocates of forfeiture reform state that this money should be intended for school districts.
That is not correct. The federal forfeiture funds are all funds that go through the federal government. When people are discussing money intended for the school district, I think generally what they're referring to would be funds that are seized and petitioned for forfeiture pursuant to state court system. That would not be any of these funds. These funds are funds that are through the federal government and through the Department of Justice, the Department of Treasury, so none of those state laws are applicable.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So that's fairly straightforward. You'll remember an item months ago about forfeiture, which brought that question. I hope this is useful information. Next item is about placing some water wells, new wells, to maintain our capacity. And Ted is here to walk us through that.
Well, thank you for your time for us to explain some of the issues we've got going on with our well sitings these days. Just to make sure you know the people that I've brought with me to help answer some questions tonight, and I hope you do have some questions for me. Ryan Williams is the Assistant Director of Water and Light. He's to my right over here, and we have Tomas Zajac, which is the Engineering Supervisor on the water side. So like I said, these guys are here to help me answer some questions that hopefully you'll have tonight. The information we're going to give you is in regards to a public hearing that we have on tonight's agenda, and this public hearing is for a resolution of necessity for construction of the wells number 16, 17, and 18 in the McBain Bottoms. The funding for this project was actually part of our 2008 water bond for this, and the funding is currently in our water and light capital improvement budgets at this moment. So to start this, I'd kind of like to start out with some history, to kind of give you some history on the well field. This slide shows a 1999 study that we did on the well fields, and at this time, once again, we were running a little bit low on the capacity, or the, should I say that we were running up against the capacity of the well field down there. At this time, there was 12 wells down at the McBain Bottoms, and we had a 24 million gallons of theoretical capacity on these wells, and I'm going to cover what the term theoretical capacity means for us. And like I said, we're getting close in that time. During this time, I do believe we had some wells that were still active in town, and so they kind of served as more of a backup function for our system. We did rely primarily on the McBain's Bottoms for the water supply at this time. At this time, our water treatment plant capacity was 24 million gallons, which matched the theoretical capacity of our well field at this time. And just something to note, that the projections that this 1999 study had for 2013, which is the upcoming summer, was 34 million gallons a day, and a 17 million gallon a day average was what kind of it had projected for our coming summer's needs. As a result of this, we ended up adding three new wells. We added two in the year 2000. We added one in 2006, and we did upgrade the water treatment plant by one additional train, which added 8 million gallons to the plant, so it took it from a 24 million gallon plant to a 32 million gallon plant. At this time, these additional wells increased our theoretical capacity of our well field up to about 30 million gallons a day. We also put two ASRs, or aquifer storage and recovery wells, in as a result of this, and these are more of a peaking type function that they operate on our system, and certainly we'd be willing to talk about ASRs going forward if you have questions of that. Moving forward, here we are at a 2008 study that we had. At this time, we have 15 wells on our system with a 30 million gallon a day theoretical capacity. And what we were actually seeing achieved out of this well field at this time was about 27 or 28 million gallons a day. Ryan, in a minute, is going to kind of go over what the actual capacities and how they behave to these wells. But we did have, like I said, about the 30 million gallon theoretical capacity out of these wells, and our water treatment plant was sitting at 32 million gallons of capacity. The projections based on this had dropped a little bit for our 2013 summer coming up. We were down to a projected peak of about 30 million gallons a day for 2013 in capacity, and about 8 million gallons a day for our average day capacity. At this time, there was no resulting actions came from this. We did go to council in 2009, I believe, late, with a request to add one more well to our system, and that was not pursued upon at that time. That was not followed through. So at this time, we haven't added anything since this report was done to either the treatment plant or the wells down here. So with that said, here's where we are today. This is what our system looks like today. This may look a little familiar to you. We have 15 wells. As you'll notice, we have different colors on there that indicates the different line sizes in our well field. So we kind of have a northern loop and a southern loop. The northern loop to our well field is the ones that covers 2, 9, and 10, and that's a 18 or 20-inch size of line that goes to the north. We have a southern loop that is the bigger size loop for us, and that covers 2, 4, 11, and 12, and goes down on that side of our loop territory down there. One thing I did want to point out with this is some of the surface waters that you'll see that should be noted in here. Obviously, the rivers to the left side of the screen you'll see going by there, and the wetlands are going to be to the northeast side of our well field, and they also on the southeast side of our well field down there. I've got a couple of more drawings that'll kind of show you where those are in more detail. So, in addition to the increasing demand that the last two studies that we did show, we also have a decreasing capacity on our system. This is a slide that I'm going to have Ryan spend a little bit of time and tell you what this really means, because the term specific capacity is not one of those things that's intuitive on what it exactly means. But these kind of show you the performance of what our wells have been over time and where they are right now.
specific capacity of a well is basically a rating on the effectiveness or efficiency of one individual, any one individual well. As you can see from this graph, we test the wells initially when we put the wells in, and then we test them periodically through their life to see where they currently are. And as you can see on this graph, the red lines indicate the initial efficiencies of the well, where the green lines indicate the current efficiencies. We are capable of modifying the efficiencies of a well. There are several things that we can do to improve the efficiencies. If you think of the well as kind of like a system, what includes not only the well and the pump, but also the strata, rock strata surrounding the well, kind of acts like a filter. And in fact, we place the wells down in the McBain alluvial bottoms because of the natural filtering effect that the alluvial aquifer provides for us. And so kind of surrounding each well, if you will, down underneath the ground, there's layers of rocks and sediment that do form a natural filter. Well, over time, these filters become restricted with sediment and things that build up. Over time, what we can do is inject treatments down in the well, which may include treatments of chlorine, acids, or pumping back high-pressure water in an attempt to rejuvenate the well. Unfortunately, we can never get the well back to its 100% perfect when it was brand new. And several of these wells have been treated multiple times. And as you can see here, as time has progressed, several of the wells, regardless of how many treatments we have given them, really haven't performed back to their original nature, which is why we have this loss out of the well field over time. And I think Tad's got another slide coming up that'll show the number of wells we have versus the projected loss.
Yeah, I do. So we'll go through this. What we have here is really a picture of this summer. This is where we operated for the year 2012 for us. The lines going across there, the first one on top, the basically 24 million gallon a day line, that is really the capacity of kind of where our well field is operating right now. The blue line that goes up and down through there is our actual pumping numbers that we had for our system. The purple line is the summer average, so I think it's the June, July, and August pumping average that we're at. And the green line is the annual average. So that would be the number based upon an annual year of what our averages were. Certainly we can store water in town to make up for what we're not capable of pumping at the time. The problem with that is our in-town storage, a lot of it is meant for two purposes. One is pressure regulation on our system. We want to keep a certain amount of elevation in our towers and our elevated storage in our reservoirs to be able to maintain pressure on our system. The second one is for fire flows. Certainly one of Water and Light's primary responsibilities to be able to maintain enough storage in town to meet our fire flow demands for our system. Certainly when the fire trucks hook up, as we've seen in some recent events, they can require quite a bit of water out of our storage in town to be able to meet this. To be able to meet a fire flow demand, it's unlikely that we can pump enough water at that time up into town to meet the fire flow. So most of our fire demands need to be met by in-town storage.
I'm going to guess. I was going to ask you how many days the water towers hold. And if I'm gathering that number is small based on the fact that just the flow for a fire would be a drain on the system.
Yeah,
we're on the order of probably.
So really not even a day.
1 million gallons.
Yeah. So you're really using it for pressure and fire?
That's really it, and that's really one of the big obligations that our operators of the water system need to maintain is not only the pressure but the in-town storage, because we need to be prepared for the fire demand, and that's one of our obligations.
That's really interesting. And how long does it take to fill them back up, given that you're already also supplying the city?
It's oftentimes that when we run during the day and we do drop them a little bit, that's one of the things they'll be doing most of the night is filling the towers back up again at night. So it's kind of an ongoing balancing act that we're always running for the in-town storage, the demand, and how much we can pump into town. So it's kind of quite a few variables in that equation. We'd have to narrow a couple of them down to be able to give you what would happen.
But that gives me the gist of how it works. Thank you.
But certainly one of the things we don't want to happen is that our on a regular basis, our in-town demand causes our operators to be drawing our fire storage down on a regular basis because we don't want to be caught, for lack of a better word, with
right.
our water
levels
down.
It would happen at the end of a hot day.
Exactly right.
Quick question.
Yes.
With the impending drought that we've had over the past couple of years and probably into some of the foreseeable future, is that having any impact on our water supply and levels in our well capacity?
It is a good time to ask that because I think the slide I got up right now kind of shows you where we've been with our water demands. The first blue line up here is kind of takes into account the reduction in the well field that Ryan alluded to when he said our wells, as time goes by, they decrease in production. The next line, which is kind of the faint red line that you'll see, that's our actual demands. So we've drawn a red line that tries to predict what we consider to be an average for the daily, but that's what our actual numbers come in at for the year. So you ask what happens. As you can see, the last year, not in 2010, 2011, we were quite a ways below the red line, what we was kind of see as an average. Last year was a fairly warm, dry summer. As you can see, we ended up quite a bit above the line. And certainly we would expect to continue our excursions probably above the line. And you can see some historical trends where you could probably correlate those 2 years that we had more water demands based upon either growth or possibly temperature or moisture conditions in our system. So that's kind of how you see us go up and down on the average line is based upon the demand on our system, and certainly hotter, dry summers do cause a bigger demand on our system. If we go back to this one, certainly when you look at this, people kind of like to say, well, your base demand is during the months of the January, February, March, and all the stuff above that is going to be demands on your system that are maybe due to irrigation or watering or all the things that happen during the hotter, drier months. How much of that would go away if we actually didn't water the lawns or didn't wash the cars, we really don't know. But we only have one water supply in town, so it all shows up under these curves. So this request that we're bringing forward to you today is a request to add 3 wells to our system. The intent is to put 2 on our system to really make up for the capacity that we've lost on our aquifer down there, our pumping capacity. And we're asking for a third one to serve as a backup on our system. And this is really something that the DNR recommends, that we have a backup on our system. If you remember I'll go back one more time to this. We had a very good operational summer. In other words, everything stayed running all summer. If we would have lost a well for whatever mechanical reason on the wrong day, we would have had some problems. We probably would have had to have done something to try to voluntarily reduce demand on our system or do something to do that. So it's nice to be able to have one well backup. And like I said, this is really something that DNR does recommend for water supply systems to have the backup, because anybody that's dealt much with mechanical system knows that about the worst time is when they're going to fail for you. Now, like I said, we did do very well this summer and was a very good operational year, and everything ran the way that it was supposed to. The other thing that I wanted to point out with this is really what this does is this basically gets us out in the future. Based upon the numbers we kind of have here, we're looking at probably about a 4 to 5 year window with these 3 wells that we would be adding, that it would basically say, you know, this is the amount of time that based upon these numbers, this is how much time that this meets our demand. So obviously there's some things that we need to do in the meantime on this time that we're meeting our demand with these new wells, and I've got a slide to cover those too. So with the understanding that we're asking to have new wells and we do have an increasing demand on our system, the next question is, where do we site the wells? They are going to have to be down on our system down there. This map came out of a previous study, and it basically shows groundwater levels in the aquifer down there. You'll see the kind of the circles on the north or the upper side of the screen. Those are the depression bars for kind of the water level, and you can see that the lower levels are around the wells that we have. And you have the arrows there that kind of show the direction of the migration of the water that we see going on the system down there. You know, on the south side of that, you'll also see kind of a water hill that's been represented down there. And so certainly water is going to try to flow from the high levels to the low levels on the McBain Aquifer down there. There's in addition to kind of the isobars or the water level lines you'll see on there, you also see the blue dots, which indicates where our wells are all located, and you also see black dots, and those are monitoring wells on our system. Now, monitoring wells are wells that are set up by the USGS and other folks down there to actually monitor the groundwater. And this one that I have here shows kind of the monitoring wells that we have. As you know, the wetlands runs in Percy Creek and kind of runs down the eastern side of that bottoms over there. The well numbers that you see that are highlighted in yellow are monitoring wells that we've seen an elevated chloride level in the well. Now, what the chloride is an indicator of the surface water affecting the groundwater down there, specifically as it would be tied to the wetlands project over there. So certainly from gauging with where we see the influence on the monitoring wells with this and which way the water kind of flows down there, the place that we want to develop the wells to avoid influence is going to be up on the north side of this McBain Bottoms down there. With that said, we had a map I showed you earlier. The infrastructure on the north side is the least favorable for us. It's the smallest pipes, and we would incur the biggest line losses to put wells on the northern side of our territory up there. The other thing is,
what kind of losses did you?
Line losses. Any time we put more wells on a smaller pipe, it takes more friction and pressure loss to push it down the pipe.
Okay.
It's just, yeah, it's like a lot of things where you put too much current in a wire or too much flow in a pipe. It just takes a lot more pressure to move it at the faster speed through the pipe. So we call them line losses.
So that's where there's less effluent with the, as indicated with the chloride tracking, but the pipes are not as
right.
Large.
And if we go up to here, this line here shows you, if we go up north where there's less influence and from the southern section of that territory, if we put wells up around where 9 or 10 are on the light blue lines up there, we're going to get less production out of the well because it's going to be fighting with all the other wells for a smaller pipe.
And is there a reason not to just put in a bigger pipe besides money?
That is the only reason, money. It is a lot of money, but we do have another reason in this case that we don't want to put them up there. So going back to this, I did want to point out where we were on the monitoring wells on this. So with that said, the biggest influence from the chlorides is going to be on the southern side of our well field down there. So the wells 5 and 6 are the ones that are on the southern side of our territory, and these are the wells that we have the most amount of chloride levels. And these are measurements that have come from the production wells 5 and 6. And as you can see, we've kind of levelized at somewhere less than 100 milligrams per liter or parts per million out of wells 5 and 6, and then those are the ones that are affected the most. Chloride is really an indicator of where, you know, the water might have come from, because there's elevated chlorides in some of the wetlands water. But the chloride is really travels faster through the ground, from what we understand, than the actual water itself. It's a thing that can actually travel faster than the water. It kind of diffuses in the water. So while it's indicating where the water might be coming from, it does travel faster than the water. And certainly that's what the aquifer does underground, is it filters the stuff out of the water that it's supposed to. The chloride does not react in the ground. It just travels through all of this. As you can see, we've kind of stabilized on what the concentration on wells 5 and 6. Chloride is not a regulated substance as such in the wells. They do have a level that for odor and taste type issues that they would like to see it below. That level is 250, and we've obviously stabilized out at under 100. So while we do see some impact, we don't see that there's an issue with drawing water from this area. That's a clear and present problem for us right now. The other thing is, what we're trying to do is put these wells in the southern area, which is the sites A and C, to make up for water loss down there. So we're trying to keep production from the wells in this area really at a constant or just a little bit more to make up for the reserve on this.
I'm gathering that in 2010, 2011, you had no data.
That's exactly right. We pulled samples up to 2010. In 2010, 2011, we just did not pull basically production levels for these wells. I'm not sure why we didn't, but we didn't pull numbers for those years, but we did back in 2012 again.
You don't say what the plus part is that goes with the minus chloride, and I'm gathering it's a mixture of whatever, calcium chloride, sodium chloride.
By plus, you mean?
The chemical, there's a
The chemical.
Plus like a sodium that would go with the chloride, which is a minus, and I'm going to gather that it's a mixture of different types of chloride compounds.
My understanding is yes. I don't think it's, obviously if it was an unstable type of setup, it would react with something down there, but it is a stable chloride, so I'm not sure what it's combined with exactly.
Uh-huh. I see what you're saying, yeah.
I think it's a sodium chloride type thing, so it's, mm-hmm.
Which there's a lot of salt in the world.
Well, there is, and that's one of the things that can actually affect the chloride levels down is the salt levels that already exist underground. Chloride is a naturally occurring thing down there. These levels are a little elevated. I would assume that some of the stuff prior to 99, which were probably running around 20 or under 20, would be probably the naturally occurring levels, whereas right now we're running right around the 80 level.
Right, because all water has sodium, even bottled water from springs.
Yes.
But the concern here is and has been throughout various studies of effluent getting into the lower wells. So I'm looking at this January 2nd, 2013 Water and Light Advisory Board meeting, and it mm-hmm. indicates that the study done by Black and Veatch, I guess the latest one, recommended that the wells go more to the north than what you're recommending, and in this memo to council of February 13th, the Water and Light Board indicate the proposed well sites B and C would be preferable from a water quality standpoint.
Right, and I was going to discuss that with a map basically showing where our placements are going, and we'll certainly go over why we want to select the sites that we did on this. So some of the things that we're looking to decide where we want to put the new wells is use of existing infrastructure. We already talked about the pipe size and where we already have the pipes in place. One of the things that we are going to talk about is keeping the future options open. As it indicated, up to the north is where we want to develop in the future. If we start putting wells there as a function of this to make up for loss of water down in the southern side where we already have infrastructure, we really want to develop kind of up north on the future expansion type things. And what we're looking for here is really to keep ourselves whole and not, it's not really a future expansion type of issue what we have here. So I want to make sure you understand there's a little difference here. Is we're trying to compensate for water loss that we're having down in this area right now. Our future expansion up there would be probably in conjunction with a water treatment plant expansion. The wells that we would probably put in today if we were looking at a true expansion thing is called a collector well, where they go down and then they kind of like a spider in the ground where they have a lot of things. Now these wells have a lot of water production with them. Our current just straight vertical drop wells are about 2 million gallons of wells. These, what they term as collector wells, can have upwards of 20 to 30 million gallons per well. So it's certainly a lot different scale, and that's the area that we want to save for the expansion to be able to do these, because if we start dropping vertical wells in an area that we would like to put a collector well in the future, it kind of causes options problems for being able to expand that direction. And like I said, we're really not adding much capacity to the existing. We're just transferring where it's coming from because some of our existing wells are dropping off on production. So we're wanting to sink a few new ones to be able to maintain the pumping capacity to compensate for what we're dropping off.
If I understand you right, you want to, as much as possible, put these three new wells in the least desirable spots to save those most desirable spots for the future. That's a little bit of an oversimplification.
Yeah, because it's really not the least desirable. We do have least desirable
less
ones,
desirable,
but based upon our existing infrastructure, this really what we think minimizes the impact from what's down there, and it puts it in a place that is best for us, leaves our current option opens, avoids the deepest water depression areas that we have right down there, and keeps the options open for us going forward in the future. And that's exactly so. Obviously there is some compromise in here. We're trying to put them in places that make sense now and keep our options open in the future for us going forward.
It would seem to me you definitely need new pipe in the north at that point.
Oh yes.
And I see your point is you do that all at the same
would, yeah, and that's one of the things I'm going to go over is some of the processes that we have going forward from here. So
it looks like it's a fairly short length, you know, when you look at the whole loop that the north line, maybe I'm misinterpreting, but it sure looks to me like the north would be the shortest, one of the shorter lengths of pipe.
Yeah, maybe a little, but like I said, certainly money is an infrastructure issue that we wouldn't want to be investing capital infrastructure into the northern loop on this and then have to come back through and dig it up again on a future expansion to put a collector well that would be going in when we already have capacity really built on the south side of our system to be able to handle the expansion of this.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
But what the chart here really shows is the sites that we have considered for our well sites going forward. So you'll see an A, a C, a B, a D, and I believe an E, if I can read all these. If you look at it just from an infrastructure perspective, certainly the size of the line really favored the A, B, and C sites on our system because they're hooked to the bigger pipes for us. Once again, we talked about the future expansion issues. We do want to keep to the north and the west of our current well field kind of, or as part of our current well field, a little open for future expansion issues. So that also kind of favored the sites A, B, and C on our system to be able to keep them in that area. From avoiding the water depression areas, we kind of had them all placed to where we avoided the deepest water depression areas on our system. One of the things that I wanted to point out with sites B is I believe that's in an area that the Department of Conservation has plans to flood on a regular basis. And while they're not going to get the level high enough to cause us problems with the motor and the controls and stuff, it does run the risk of causing us potential access problems to the wells if we have to take a boat over to the wells to be able to service them all the time, in addition to the electrical supply that it would take to fund those things. And plus, wells B are kind of on the eastern side of our territory, which is kind of in between the wetland cells to the north and the wetland cells to the south. On the monitoring wells, we don't really see much showing up in the groundwater in that area yet, but it is on the side over there that we feel like has the potential to be influenced over there. So like the Water and Light Advisory Board said, they did vote 4-1 to endorse the recommendations for A and C. If you look in the minutes, we did get an approval with a 4-1 vote to approve the sites that we recommend, which is the A sites and the C sites on this. The other thing that we're doing with the Water and Light Advisory Board, and this is something they requested, is we've just started the setup of basically a water management planning subcommittee that's going to be ran under the Water and Light Department. And the purpose of this is to really kind of address some public policy type planning concerns on what are we going to do for water management. There's certainly the concern that there's water usage on our potable water system that doesn't require potable water to meet. Irrigation, washing, I mean, there's needs in there that you could say doesn't need potable water to meet. Now, where's the water going to come from? I mean, it would be unlikely that we could set up two distribution systems on our system where one potable, one not. But there are examples throughout the United States in water restricted areas that they found a way to have more local storage of water to meet the needs on a more local basis. And our intention is to work with the public work staff on their stormwater stuff. We have two of the advisory board members who are going to serve on this. We have the sustainability folks and the Water and Light staff are all going to partner on this thing and really spend some time to kind of come up with a recommendation of how are we going to go forward from a community scale on how do we handle water consumption, water management, water issues going forward. That's going to have to involve some public policy discussions as we make these recommendations going forward to you guys. And that kind of goes back to the window of opportunity that I talked about. These wells kind of buy us about a 4 or 5 year window opportunity, this being one of the things that we're going to need to get done fairly early in this time frame to be able to do some planning in addition to just the plain supply planning that's going on.
What's the limit of the number of wells that you can have feeding into that 36-inch pipe?
Well, once again, it kind of comes down to a production thing. We can put wells, but as you add to them, then you're going to drop because you get to it. From just a hydraulic study, I don't know if Tomas has an idea of how many wells you can tie in the pipe.
Well, because the farther you get away from the plant, the smaller your diameter is getting because you can't push all that water into the same pipe, into that 36-inch pipe. So if you put in the collector wells up north, are you going to put in all new supply pipes for those?
Yes, that's exactly right. As a matter of fact, when we put a collector well to north, it's really going to have to involve a water treatment plant expansion and a lot of new infrastructure in the bottom. So it's going to be a big issue. I mean, it's going to be a big where we source it from, how we treat it, and how do we transport it. So it's going to be a big issue. Hence, it makes sense to really spend some time on the demand side of this equation to say how, from a public perception, you know, from a public policy standpoint, what should we be doing as a community to either push off this expansion or, you know, how do we manage this side of the equation for us?
I was going to follow up with a question. Do you or does the sustainability director have any economic information on the economics of demand management versus the economics of, like if you took this, like let's say you drilled two wells instead of three and you put the money for the third well into conservation programs such as rain barrels, local storage, that sort of thing. Is there any data on the cost effectiveness of that?
I don't know of any right now. Certainly these effectiveness is going to change a little bit geographically depending on where you're at, the price of water, the resources, how much it costs to treat it, where it comes from. That's really some of the things that we're going to try to work forward to do. As a matter of fact, on my next last slide, I've got one of the strategic planning goals that we put together for Water and Light is to do what's called a water integrated resource plan. That's something that we want to put together to really incorporate not only the resources or the supply side but the demand side and kind of come up with the equations that exactly what you're talking about there. Now, we have these numbers that we have done on the electric side of the house, and so we put those together. But for the water side of the house, it's a lot younger in its in its development. So the answer is we don't really have those numbers put together right now. And those are some of the things that we do need to put together when we come forward back to you at some day in the future and say, here's some of the demand programs, here's what we think the benefit, here's the cost. So you have these cost-benefit ratios that we have established on the electric side that we need to establish on the water side of the house to be able to make these decisions.
Yeah, it would be nice to do so. And I've seen, Mike, look, didn't we join a consortium of cities about 2 or 3 months ago that is sharing this kind of information, and I specifically did remember water not being part of that,
right?
But perhaps it is.
Yeah, I think the utilities, both the water and the electric, were not necessarily a common city function like that.
There are 15 templates in the ICMA benchmarking, and none of those 15 are water or light.
Well, I guess we're going to lead the way then, aren't we?
But the main point is that treating water and expanding our water treatment plant as well as digging wells is very expensive. And the more we can not treat water that isn't drunk but is for irrigation, most likely, and that's what you'll be looking at, we'll be saving money in the long run.
Yeah, I can tell you from a utility perspective, we were very much all in favor of putting out infrastructure of new resources as long as we economically can make it happen and still serve the role. And so it's, we certainly are going to spend some time and effort investigating exactly that. I mean, you know, what can we do on our system to be able to manage the demand. But there's going to be some public policy decisions in there that we'll have to bring forward some recommendations out of this subcommittee and say.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'm guessing that if there were a way to store stormwater, people would be working on it, and that would solve two problems.
Yes, and that's certainly why we're involving the public works and the sustainability folks, because, I mean, it's not only is there public policy decisions that are going to be kind of difficult, but there's just some technical feasibility supply issues from a local perspective is how do we do this and how do we encourage that and what should be the city's role to do that?
It's a complicated balance. I think no one disagrees that we shouldn't make those sort of options available moving forward. What we don't know right now is how effective they are at a big picture. You know, what percentage decrease might we see if we gave away the house? I don't think anyone knows that answer either. So this will be a balance of policy, maybe some pilot programs, as well as recognizing that we're in historically hot temperatures. We had a drought last year. We will likely have a drought again. They tend to go in two-year cycles. So, you know, if the rain barrels don't do much in those scenarios. So we have to balance out the weather patterns we have with the options available. So the system, the difficult work of the utility is how do we make sure we have enough water for what we really need with all those other variables weighed in it. So we tend to be conservative to make sure we have enough water. But it's very likely
that. Yeah, you don't want to run out. That makes the public very unhappy.
That's right. Well, we're blessed. We're surrounded by water. But, you know, there are cities that have to very carefully manage it, right, about you're simply not permitted to water your lawn. In Phoenix, they will give you money to take your grass away and put lava rocks down, right? So they have much more extreme problems we don't have to deal with here. But we still have to wrestle with some of these issues and see a state after the integrated resource plan where we really have tied all these things together and have some idea about what we can expect from those programs.
And just one quick question. So with the water integrated resource plan, you'll look at our master meter system and some of those issues to see if that creating more individual meters will
absolutely
create more conservation.
Those are all issues that need to be taken into account. I mean, if there's truly water conservation advantages that would be able to come out of that, all those things I would expect to be, you know, certainly considered in there. I mean, you know, with the master meter thing, though, I mean, certainly it's some of that is tried to reflect not only, you know, how we charge, but how it costs us as a utility, because we have to send meter readers out to read all these meters, and we also have the billing system to support the expansion of all these meters. So it's, you know, there's obviously an expense that goes with the revenue, and our base charges have been trying to, understand the fixed cost and recover fixed cost as they are imparted on our system with some of those things. Certainly, though, it has been a benefit to customers on our system with the master meter accounts. I mean, that's a customer relations issue, too.
I think Mr. Dudley has a question.
Referring to your picture that you have here, 2 and 7 on your well-specific capacity are two of the worst wells that you've got. You're putting D is pretty close to those. How close can you put a well to that and not have the sedimentation problem exacerbating it for the other ones?
Yeah, and that's really why we didn't select D. I mean, that's one of the reasons. That's one thing I was going to point out on this, that make sure you guys know that the sites that we want to recommend or we'd like to get the approval for the resolution of necessity to proceed with are A and C. So on this map, A and C are the ones that we would like to proceed with. B would also be in the running. The reason they were a little disfavorable to us is because they will basically be surrounded by water for part of the year, so it makes access to them a little worse for us, for physical access to them. In addition, it seems to be on the side that we're concerned may have a little bit more surface water influence possibly than over toward the other side of the aquifer over there.
How long does it take to build a well? Could you have it on the drawing board and
–
considering design had a chance. Probably most likely our earliest would be the fall.
Yeah. Where I'm going would be is if you could build a minimal amount and then have another one ready to put in as quickly as possible if 2014 turns out to be like 2013-14 turn out to be like 2012.
Yes, and certainly that's what the engineers folks would take a look at and see how we stage these things to get them in the most, you know, manner. It would be certainly nice to have one in production for this summer, but that would be a challenge for us to make that. And that's our next big concern is this summer for us.
Let me change the subject briefly with a very simple question. In 1987, we changed our wastewater strategy. We moved to putting our treated wastewater in the wetlands adjacent to our water supply. And, you know, very simply, people asked then, are you sure that's a smart thing to do? And you monitor that with chloride levels. And so we've gone in our water levels in chloride from 19 milligrams per liter, which is what's in the Missouri River, right?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Over 100 milligrams per liter in some of these wells. And the conclusion is that it had to come from the wastewater treatment facility. And so that you're using it as, we're not worried about the chloride. That's not enough chloride to bother us.
That's the indicator.
The obvious question is, you know, it's a surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff in wastewater. There's antibiotics, there's hormones, there's chemicals. And I know you did a USJ study, or had a USJ study and an environmental study from the University of Missouri. But in the face of a fivefold increase of chloride levels because of flow from the wastewater treatment plant, how can the public at large be confident in the water we're drinking? Very simple question.
Yeah, well, very simple question.
The question is simple.
You know, we certainly try to use the chlorides as a surrogate on how much. Unfortunately, you know, it very well could have an influence, but that's the purpose of what we're going through underground with there. I mean, in all the studies that we've seen, all the source water protection plan folks have been through here, while the chlorides do not react going through the ground, the rest of the stuff that theoretically you would say you don't want in the water, it's not going to make it down there. And so there's not a direct connection as such. So it goes through what we have as an aquifer down there to be able to make that transit. Now, we certainly keep track of those things. We meet all the state requirements on those, and we look at that. And certainly that's one of the things we're going to look at in the planning is to minimize the influence of these things, where are we going to go with it?
So well, a corollary of that is our strategy of putting our wastewater that close to our source of drinking water. Is that a common strategy?
I do know that when the city of Chicago built its initial sewer and water system in the, I believe it was around 1900, for economic reasons, they located the water intake of Lake Michigan within a mile of the sewer outflow, and it had something to do with currents and levels. And so,
yeah, but look at Chicago now.
it hasn't been good for their baseball team, but I'm not sure if there are any other measurable effects.
There are actually folks that I wouldn't say connect the pipe, but they have a treatment process that basically takes one and does whatever it needs to make it suitable for the other. So, I mean, it's, you know, depending on the water supply and the scarcity of the water and what expense you're willing to go through to be able to use the resources that you have, there's different levels that you could go through on this. So we feel like, you know, certainly one of the things we're doing here is we're trying to keep capacity off our the existing resources you have and keep where we want to go in the future open for. So we feel like this is the compromise that, we're not really pulling really a whole lot more from our existing area, keeping open where we want to go in the future.
And it's my memory that the suggestion had been raised to pump the wastewater further south on the conservation area to minimize the influence. Is that still being considered?
Well, I think that's where it goes from the south. And if you'll see that the one chart I have, that's kind of where we're seeing the influences on the southern side of our system.
Right. But there was suggestion, I believe, I had heard from the Water and Light Board that it might be improved if the city pumped the wastewater further away from the wells in a different point on the department with the wetlands.
And I don't really have a good understanding how far you south you'd have to go. I know there's a limit to be able to, on this, you know, with the way the river runs, there's only so far south you can go before you're in the river
in
again.
The river. Yeah.
Let me just make a couple common sense comments, because the mayor's point are right on. On a common sense level, you do kind of scratch your head, why there? You know, there are engineering reasons to do that, and I will say the water that we get from our wells is cleaner than the river. So, you know, we start with using nature to filter out a whole bunch of stuff that people who use river water don't get. So we're starting better off, and my understanding is that, you know, when you do the lab test, the water coming out of the wetland is also cleaner than that you find in the river in general. Of course, the river becomes, in many ways, that's where most of the every city upstream is also dumping into in one way or another. So I like having wells versus the river water in many ways. And but to all that, this plan really keeps us in business but preserves. We know that we're going to go north. Everything in this tells us we're going to go north for our future. For all those reasons, get it separate, but we know it's a fairly significant investment to go north. So integrated resource plan will really lay out the whole vision that we can then cost and start to build.
This next slide I've really already covered, so my last one is just to kind of go over, in addition to these three wells, here's some of the steps we plan on going in the future. We do have a water treatment plant study that we're just now finishing up, or is almost done, is basically saying how much does it cost to expand the plant and what's the options for doing that. The other one is a condition assessment that we'll probably be doing on the plant, and it's saying of the equipment that's there, what's it going to cost us to keep and how much should we save and how much should we plan on replacing. We talked about water modeling for the aquifer down there. I think the last set of data was probably about 30 years old that we have from that area. So our intention is to kind of get a more up-to-date, clear understanding of the modeling for the water flow in that area. That would be something that's really important. The other thing we're doing is basically a long-range water planning study, and that's really a distribution and transmission issue. But what it does is it establishes our load forecast going forward and how we need to expand the system to meet what load. So there's going to be some demand-side practices that we're going to need to incorporate in that study. I did also talk about the Water and Light Board subcommittee that's going to kind of cover water management planning. It's going to kind of go over the public policy aspects of these things, what recommendations we have, how would we interface with the stormwater, with sustainability, and try to roll all these into some recommendations that advisory board can bring forward to the council. And here's some ideas. And really what we want to do, and this is part of our strategic plan, is to roll all these things in together and really put a water integrated resource plan, similar to what we do on the electric side, to kind of integrate all these demand side managers, supply issues together with all the regulations that we know at the time that are here and are coming, and come up with an integrated plan going forward and say, here's what we want to do. And the window of time that we're trying to buy is with these three wells, about a four-year window of time to get these things done and bring something forward and be able to plan the future going forward with our water supply with this. So that's what the public hearing that we have is going to be about tonight, and I promise it'll be a little shorter.
Let's take a break, and I plan to start promptly at 7 o'clock for the regular meeting.